If you
it's probably just my shortage of broadband. But go ahead and record, yeah.
Amazing. Thank you, everyone. Okay, so I think it is 6:35, so we shall get started. Hello, everybody. I hope you're all having an absolutely wonderful evening, and welcome to the first FOTBot webinar of 2024. Woo! I'm absolutely delighted to be hosting the Maritime Archaeology Sea Trust for tonight's webinar. My name is Reem Ibrahim, and I work in the events team here at the Friends of the British Overseas Territories, in case you didn't know who I am. So, MAST was founded back in 2011, and it was founded effectively, and I'm sure they'll tell me if I've got this right, but sort of to bridge the sort of gaping disparity in the way in which underwater maritime cultural heritage is being protected. And I feel as though it's a little bit less well known to cultural heritage on land. So over the last 12 or so years, MAST has become a champion for maritime heritage in the UK and have conducted some fantastic archaeological projects, established and sort of running the Maritime Observatory, which we'll hear a little bit about today, in order to detect and deter the unauthorized salvage across the world's oceans, and sort of quietly influencing heritage management by government, as well as increasing public awareness as well. So we all know a little bit about conservation as a result of the last few. Can we just make sure we're muted? Sorry. We all know a little bit about conservation as a result of the last few webinars that we've hosted, but we haven't heard much at all about what that looks like and what cultural heritage looks like in the ocean. So I'm really excited to be learning more about that today. So we're absolutely delighted to be joined by Jessica Berry and Giles Richardson. Jessica is the founder and CEO of MAST. She is an author and maritime archaeologist, and she has an MA and MA honor and a CIFA. She is a visiting fellow of Bournemouth University, a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries, and a fellow at the Royal Geographical Society. She's a former journalist with UK Broadsheets, and after completing her master's at Flinders University in Australia, she worked internationally as a maritime archaeologist, first in Australia as assistant curator at the Western Australian Maritime Museum, before working for Wessex Archaeology as a project supervisor, and then at the Association for the Development of for the Development of Maritime Archaeological Research in Rennes, France. She was part of the project team excavating the Swash Channel wreck back in 2010, a 17th century Dutch armed merchantman off Poole in Dorset. She is the archaeological advisor for the 1685 Coronation Wreck in Cornwall. She is the HSA scuba and HSE SSDE, a Paddy Open Water instructor and an SSI instructor, and holds a commercially endorsed advanced powerboat license. Jessica is absolutely amazing. I follow you. A big round of applause. It is an absolutely wonderful human being who has incredible amounts of knowledge that I'm so excited to learn more about today. And we also have the wonderful Giles Richardson. He joined MAST back in 2018 as an Invincible project diver, and is now the senior archaeologist and senior analyst for the Maritime Observatory, which again we'll hear a bit about today. He holds qualifications in ancient history and in archaeology from Durham, Southampton, and Oxford, and he's worked across Europe and the Mediterranean region. He was a visiting research fellow at the University of Bath's History of Technology Research Unit from 2017 to 2019. And his interests include the archaeology of the Victorian Royal Navy. He holds an HSE surface supply, offshore top-up, and professional scuba qualifications, and is a BSAC advanced diver and open water instructor, and a Paddy Open Water instructor. So, without further ado, thank you both so much for joining me today. You absolutely wonderful people who have amazing things to be teaching us, and I'm so excited to learn a bit about it. And before we get started, If any of you have any questions that are listening at the moment, make sure you can pop them into the chat box on the call, or if you would like to raise your hand once we get to the Q&A session after the wonderful Giles and Jessica have finished speaking, then we can also do that as well. So just keep in mind, you can ask questions, either pop them in the chat or be ready to raise your hand when I say so. Amazing. So without further ado, Giles, would you like to share your screen? And I hand over to the lovely Jessica.
Hello, everybody. No, I'm just going to give a very brief. Can you all hear me? Is that yes?
Yeah, we can hear you.
A brief introduction to MAST, and then Giles is going to take you on a whistle stop tour of all the exciting things we have started doing. So, MAST. I like to think of it as a kind of one-stop shop. The picture you see in the background there is the our conservation and archaeological centre in Poole. It's the only cradle-to-grave or seabed-to-museum capability in this country. Basically, that means that anything you raise from the seabed within the law can come to us. We conserve it, we study it, we research it, and then it will go to Museum of Choice, which all started when we began the excavation of the first HMS Invincible back in 2017 with £2.5 million from LIBOR, which was very, very useful. So that's our main bread and butter. Although that's how we started, we have many other strings to our bow, which we are essentially a maritime archaeological centre and striving to become a centre of excellence. One of the smaller strings to our bow is what I like to think of as a Swiss Army penknife of a database called the Royal Navy Lost List. This basically has nearly all, I mean, I'd like to say all, but there's always one that I've missed out. All the Royal Navy losses since the Royal Navy began in the early 15th century. Where it sank, if known, date, etc. So it makes it not only one of the most fantastic research tools, but also rather useful if you're trying to work out what is of value and what we've got 15 others of and not to get excited about. And we're developing this with the National Museum of the Royal Navy and the Royal Navy itself. Other things that we do is we work closely with our government departments in this country, from the Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, DCMS, and Historic England. We have done multiple projects with most of them. And one of the things that I'm quite proud of recently is the work we've done with the Foreign Office, first of all, build their underwater cultural heritage, I've forgotten how to say it now, legislation in the British Antarctic Territory, which when they published a synopsis, it was unfortunate that it contained no underwater sites, and they didn't have a law to protect any of their sites at all. So we built both, and Giles will tell you more about this, but we in the words of Donald Rumsfeld, built them a database showing them their known knowns and their unknown unknowns, which was rather timely because Endurance was discovered only just afterwards. And finally, and then I will leave Giles to fill in the details, we deal in deterrence. We've harnessed the growing capabilities of the commercial satellite world to our purposes. So whilst MAST focuses on the OSINT and the human intelligence, our partners, OceanMind, whose bread and butter is preventing illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, We work very closely with them in order to prevent bad actors at sea involved in the unauthorized looting of sites. One of the most recent ones, and is now, it turns out, ongoing as of again yesterday, is the return of looters to the HMS Prince of Wales in the South China Sea. So that's one of our really exciting new toys, and we're working very hard with MOD on this, and at the moment also the Malaysian government. I'm going to hand over to Giles, who's going to fill in all of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jessica. So that's absolutely fantastic introduction. What I'm going to do for the rest of this talk is give you a sort of whistle-stop overview of all the different aspects of underwater and maritime heritage that MASA is involved in. And the guiding principle of all our work is, as Jessica alluded to already, you've got to understand what you have in order to be able to protect it. And you've got to have a means of protection if you want to protect it. And you've got to have a way of sustaining it as well and making it available to the public, because heritage on its own, forgotten, is half lost already. And
Indeed.
there's three ways that we do this. The first way, which involves a couple of the British Overseas Territories, and we'd really like it to be more, is our ability to do desk-based assessments, where we scan all the resources we can to find out everything we can about underwater heritage. As Jessica already alluded to, our first big project was a couple of years ago now, very timely, in the British Antarctic Territories and South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands. And what we were able to do was elevate their existing resources, because they already had a fairly good understanding of what was on the surface, but fill in all the blanks. Much like the UK, both Antarctica and South Georgia and all the surrounding islands are effectively maritime economies, and successive ways of exploitation running back through history from the 17th century and 18th century have left their successive marks on the islands. I'm not going to go into too much detail today, because that would be a whole separate talk. And what if we want to give you an overview, but just to highlight that aspect. And there's unique elements of maritime heritage within the islands, and because of the preservation, particularly because no one goes there, but also a little bit due to the environment, it's cold, it's dark, all the beasties that normally like eating wooden ships don't survive very well there. There's a much better, well-preserved selection of vessels and maritime sites in the Antarctic and Southern Ocean regions than you find anywhere else. These range from the well-known important sites like the Endurance at the bottom, to the humble, such as the water boat on the left, a unique design that you don't find anywhere else in Antarctica. And the other element I'd like to highlight from our desk-based work is how much increasing pressure there is on maritime heritage. In Antarctic territories, we found that was a fairly unique pressure. These sites have gone from relative obscurity, perhaps even 10 years ago, in a few cases becoming tourist attractions in their own right. Lovely example I give you here is the Governoran. She started life in the 1890s as a large but pretty humble transport vessel. Her main role she was built for in the UK was to transport live cattle between markets in Europe. She had a fairly long career doing that. And when she was worn out, she was sold into the whaling enterprises, and she was converted into a factory ship. She was moved, relocated down into South Shetland Islands, and she was serving as a factory ship when she suffered a catastrophic fire during the First World War, unrelated to the war. This was just an accident, as often happened in whaling fleets. And she half sank into the seabed in the harbour. And she hasn't moved since, and she's almost been left unchanged since then. For our work, we'll be able to show all the artifacts that have been taken off by souvenir hunters over time. So pretty much everything that was above the waterline, unfortunately, has been stripped away or burnt away in the original fire. But below the waterline, you have an absolutely perfectly preserved factory ship from the First World War period, showing all the equipment, all the items that whalers would have found important in this early industrial period. As I said, the site was fairly forgotten for much of our history, but as Antarctic tourism is increasing, as you can see from my image here, she's now object of fascination. And there's even now, as of 2023 and 2024, diving expeditions being launched to photograph her. And again, there's the risk that those areas that were underwater and were safe for so long from prying fingers may start to suffer degradation as well. So we hope we can work with the Antarctic government, Foreign Office, and others to help protect this. We also really enjoy filling in the blanks of history as well. So one of the little side points of our work in South Georgia was there is a fantastic collection of First and Second World War support vessels for the Navy, particularly minesweepers, mine hunters, and other vessels that just simply don't survive anywhere in Europe because they were either sent to scrapyard or they were sunk during the war. Some of those that did survive were converted to other uses in the whaling industry, and they sailed down the Southern Ocean, where at the end of their lives they either sank or they were abandoned. The story of the whalers themselves is fairly well known, but the history that connects to the wartime is not very well known. It's something we enjoyed working on. Example here, motor minesweeper 213, built in 1942, served distinction in Dover before she was transferred to the Free French Navy and spent several eventful years keeping French ports clear. She was purchased by the whaling fleets in South Georgia and moved down to Grytviken, where she actually was laid up and sank in 1964, probably just from the sheer weight of snow pressing down her decks and a lack of maintenance and pumping for several years as the industry declined. One of the little things we were able to prove was the mast that was always assumed to be sticking out of the harbour to be her cannot be because it has a spotter's seat in the top. So it must be from a whaler. She was never a whaler. She was used as a support vessel, and the mast should be different. So she's somewhere else in the harbour, yet to be found. If anyone wants to ask me more questions about Antarctica and the other areas that we've done Desbec assessments in and the history, I'd be delighted to ask it afterwards. But the other bit I wanted to talk to you about is our work using satellites to protect heritage. This includes areas such as Antarctica, but our work extends beyond the BOTs into anywhere where British maritime heritage remains. As you can imagine, we have a long and storied history, and that legacy has left thousands of shipwrecks, both in UK waters and around the world. And preserving them, protecting them from threats is a serious and ongoing challenge. Maritime Observatory is a non-profit partnership between us, as the history experts, and Ocean Mind, who bring the satellite technology and technical expertise. And this is a service we've been running for several years now, quite successfully. And we use the same kind of tools that have been used for a few years now in monitoring things such as fishing and fishing fleets and applying that to underwater heritage and protecting wrecks, particularly from looting, salvage, but also other threats as well. The case that I'm going to give to you, I'm afraid it's not from a BOT, simply because we haven't got a good case study to give you yet, but it is very current and it is equally applicable to anywhere in the BOTs as well. This is from the waters off Malaysia, and it concerns the battleship HMS Prince of Wales and battlecruiser Repulse. Both vessels were unfortunately lost in 1941 when they were attempting to protect Singapore, and they came under sustained Japanese air attack. There was a very fierce battle, but unfortunately, it also heralded the end of the big gun battleship era, as neither of these ships were able to survive unsupported against waves of air attack, and both were sunk with great loss of life among the fleet. Until about 10 years ago, both ships remained in about 60 meters of water and they were very well preserved. They were starting to be explored by divers, and we were starting to learn more about how these ships were sunk and also how they're lying on the seabed today. Unfortunately, they've no longer been allowed to rest in peace. Like all good stories do, this story started on social media, and we started getting alerts around this time last year, around Easter, that a fisherman had been gone out to the Prince of Wales site to fish and encountered a very large crane barge sitting over the top of the site. And he was chased away rapidly by a small support vessel that didn't want him around. Pretty quickly after that, on TikTok, this video rather unadvisedly was posted by the owner of a local scrapyard close to Singapore, showing an enormous crane barge, the same one, unloading what could only have been a 5.2-inch naval gun, clearly indicating that it had come off a shipwreck. And linking that with this, with the photo from the fisherman, we knew immediately that the site was under threat. Being a small charity, we were able to pivot quite nimbly when emergencies arise, and we were able to throw our resources into the investigation to what exactly was going on in Malaysia. We were able to identify the crane barge very quickly as the Chanhong 68. She is a particularly large grab dredger built in China in 2014. And we were actually familiar with her because she'd been linked to a number of previous instances of illegal salvage in Indonesian and South China Seas waters. And she'd actually disappeared from the radar for about 3 or 4 years because she'd been chased away by local law enforcement. At the same time, Malaysian authorities raided the scrapyard where this TikTok video was posted, and they immediately uncovered large piles of scrap metal, clearly from various ships, but among them some very obvious objects that could have only come from a warship, including piles of British-made naval-type ammunition. Using our satellite resources, we were able to start reconstructing the story of what had happened. What we found was quite shocking. Using AIS, that's the automatic system that's transmitted from ships to show their position around the world. It's a safety device. We were able to demonstrate this vessel had sailed out of the same scrapyard, which is just opposite from Singapore, and had travelled up through the South China Sea while transmitting. What was interesting, though, was this signal dropped away when she was about 100 miles south where the Prince of Wales and Repulse wrecks were. And we think this is a clear attempt by the vessel to try and evade the protections that they knew were on the site, because they knew the UK government was using AIS monitoring as a way of protecting Prince of Wales and Repulse after previous damage had occurred. Using satellite imagery, we're able to find some really quite graphic images of the ship unloading scrap metal in the scrapyard. And we're able to show that during the periods when she wasn't transmitting, there was a large vessel about 100 meters long sitting over top of the Prince of Wales wreck. And she'd been there for almost 6 months by the time that she was noticed in April 2023. And also, as her work had progressed, the ship was upside down on the seabed. This grab dredger, which looks much like one of those fairground ride or toys you use to pick up prizes and nearly always end up dropping them. This had smashed through first the fuel tanks and then the magazines, which explains the large amount of ammunition that's been brought up onto the deck and onto the beaches of Malaysia. And we could find clearly in these images an oil slick over 10 kilometers in length as the fuel oil, which had been trapped for 80 years inside the ship, was released and allowed to freely spill across the South China Sea towards Malaysia, potentially causing a very, very nasty environmental incident. On the ground, we were able to help our Malaysian colleagues in identifying the objects and building a case against the salvors. And one of the key objects here is the anchors. These were very distinctive. They're British made. They're very large, of a type that was a size and type that only fitted to Prince of Wales. They're not the same as, for instance, you'd find on Prince, sorry, on Repulse. Not the same kind that you'd find on a Japanese warship of the same era, and not really the kind or size that you'd find on a modern cargo ship either. So a clear key indicator that these did come from Prince of Wales, and further reinforcing satellite work we did. Partially thanks to our investigation and thanks to the diligence of Malaysian authorities, they were able to seize the vessel when it was at sea. It had already fled into international waters, but it was nonetheless arrested, and it is still under arrest to this day. The crew are currently going through the court procedure, and the evidence that we've collected is going to be part of that investigation. However, we were a little bit curious on the back of this investigation why this salvage barge, which still had arrest warrants out for it in Indonesia, had been allowed to do work in Malaysia, and how long it had been in the area. So we were able to reconstruct its activities during 2022. And again, we found quite shockingly that there was a covert pattern of illegal salvage of historic ships that had been going on unnoticed for a year and a half. In each case, methods were quite similar. She would get a, well, the owner would get a salvage contract legitimately for a modern ship, often one that sunk quite recently. And the vessel would sail out to the site from a local port. It would clearly be transmitting on AIS, openly showing what it's doing. It would start salvage work on this site. And then after a couple of days, the signal would drop out. During this dark period, we found the ship would then relocate to a nearby historic wreck, preferably a large one that would generate a lot of high quality armor plate and other scrap metal. And this example's on the right here. This is while salvaging a modern ocean liner, which sank in 1999, she actually relocated to the Japanese heavy cruiser Higiro and spent several weeks on top of that site recovering metal. When she'd completed her work, she would then move back to the original site she had the permit for, turn the AIS on, and then wait about a day or so, and then would travel back into the port. Quite a clever idea. It wouldn't have raised a lot of suspicions from anyone monitoring her movements online. And any port inspections that were done when she sailed in, particularly customs, would have looked at deck for the scrap metal, and they wouldn't have known whether that was old scrap metal from a historic wreck or new scrap metal from a modern ship. And that metal was then passed into informal metal in processing industries around Malaysia and other countries too. And so unfortunately, most of that material was lost forever. I'm pleased to say, of course, that she's is under arrest, and hopefully we should prevent that happening again. A quick update as of this week, we have also now detected some more activity over Prince of Wales in the last couple of days, and we're furiously investigating which vessel that would have involved. It can't have been the Chang Hong 68. Well, she should still be under lock and key, but we do think that someone else has taken the opportunity of Ramadan when things are a little quieter and that people aren't watching to try and have another go and finish the job. Not all our work is attacking bad guys. We also work very closely with the fishing industry to try and prevent accidental damage. Fishermen unfortunately do collide with wrecks sometimes. It's something they desperately want to avoid because it damages their equipment. And we're able to provide a monitoring service to heritage agencies and also to conservation agencies to try and mitigate this risk and help protect both fishermen and sites. Example in the middle of the screen is a Second World War floating tank, a Valentine tank from Poole Bay, just from very close to where I'm talking to you from. Until 2 years ago, this was the most intact floating tank we had left on seabed, lost during exercises prior to D-Day. Unfortunately, she was clocked over the head and the turret was flipped off sometime over winter 2022 2023. Using our technologies and our tools, we were able to demonstrate that this wasn't a fishing boat as initially suspected, but was almost certainly a local dive charter vessel that unfortunately got the marker buoy tangled up with the turret. But they did not report it because they were very afraid of prosecution, it being a protected site, which is why it wasn't reported. We use this method and we use this kind of technology for as many clients as possible. And we've recently completed work on a fragile ancient battlefield site off Sicily. Again, sorry, it's not a bot, but it's very applicable to the kind of work that we'd love to be able to do in some more bots. In this case, this is the oldest ancient battlefield site known where we have any archaeological remains. It was from the last Punic War between Carthage and Rome, and large numbers of warships on both sides were sunk. Very little of these warships remains today, but the bronze rams at the front survive well, and behind them is an ethereal scatter of all the objects that would have been important to the crew, such as spears, shields, helmets, and amphora containing water and food, all of which are incredibly important, very hard to find on land, and this is the best assemblage that we have. But it only takes one trawler dragging a net through the middle of the site to scatter those objects, break them, remove the context, and destroy a lot of the value of them. Work very closely with Sicilian authorities, thanks to funding from the Honor Frost Trust, to understand patterns of fishing in the area. It's a marine protected area, so there shouldn't be any heavy bottom trawling. But we were able to demonstrate that there was still some activity going on, and we've helped authorities engage with the owners to make sure this doesn't happen again, particularly to educate the owners about where they can and can't be trawling. So it's a proactive and reactive process, and we hope it's positive for the local community and for the archaeologists as well. And the final slide I'm going to give you is the other pillar of the work that we do, both as an archaeology charity and as a satellite monitoring charity, and that's protecting the environment from the legacies of war, particularly First and Second World War in Europe and also around the world. Sank a lot of tonnage, and a lot of vessels sank with very sensitive cargoes, including fuel oils and ammunition. It's now 80 years since the Second World War. It's over 100 years since the First World War. And these hulls are now breaking down, and these pollutants now starting to leak into the ocean. So we're able to offer a monitoring service where we can spot pollution when it happens and direct authorities in order to mitigate this. The best success we've had with this is the RFA Darkdale, which some of you may be aware of. It's a few years old now, but it's a large oil tanker that was serving as an RFA refueling point in St Helena, serving to refuel British submarines and British ships in this remote outpost. It was unfortunately spotted and torpedoed by U-68 in 1941 and sank with the loss of 41 crew. She remained intact on the seabed, cut in half by the torpedo, but otherwise very well preserved until about 2012, when reports started surfacing of oil leaking onto the beaches. It was clear that the fuel tanks, which originally assumed to have been destroyed in the initial torpedo explosion, had remained intact, and as they were starting to rust through, the oil was leaking out. MOD Salvage and Marine, fantastic organisation that we work very closely with, were able to spring into action, and they commissioned MASS to do the initial desk-based assessment. So we were able to feed them with all the important information, such as the ship's plans, where they would expect to find the oil on the ship, what sort of levels of preservation they would find, and effectively briefing them as fully as possible while they could do their work. They were very successful, and over a series of campaigns between 2012 and 2015, they were able to pump out all the oil from this wreck, much of which is actually able to be resold back for refining back into the industry, partly paying for the operation. But it protects St Helena from this legacy of pollution, and it also protects the wreck. It was a fairly non-destructive process, only small holes need to be drilled into it, and it's now a very popular diving site, which hopefully will draw tourists back to St Helena and encourage them to explore the maritime heritage of this really fascinating area. That's all I wanted to bombard you with, and look forward to hearing any questions you may.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Charles. That was really wonderful. Thank you, Charles and Jessica, for that wonderful presentation. I'm going to take the privileges as chair to ask my first question. But of course, any of you who have any questions, please do pop them in the chat or feel free to pop your hand up as well if you'd like to ask anything. So when I was looking through your website and sort of preparing for this and sort of listening to what you were talking about today about those three words that really define your organization: protection, policy, and research. And you mentioned, I think it was Jessica that mentioned the work that you guys did with the Foreign Office. So I was just wondering, what kind of protocol that looks like. If you were to discover something, do you then start working with the government, or do you, or does it happen the other way around? Do you work with the government and then start exploring and sort of get those things? And also, just as sort of sub question, what would the protocol be when you find an object that could be your fascination, or an object that could be that needs to be protected? So, for example, with the shipwreck that was found on TikTok on the side of Malaysia, what's the protocol actually look like when a discovery is made and then sort of processes to conserve it occur?
I think we can probably both answer a bit of that. It does depend on where in the world you are when you are discovering said object. If you're in the UK and British waters, within territorial waters, there are all sorts of different protocols, really, depending on what type of site you're on. If it's a wreck site, you're planning to raise something which you shouldn't be, unless it's not protected, then you have 1 month to declare it to the receiver of wreck. Then he has to find the original owner, or there's discussion about where it might end up and what sort of reward there might be. If, however, if you mentioned TikTok, that was us and the Maritime Observatory doing our research and discovered, on the strength of this TikTok video, what illegal goings on were occurring, and then we started We brought in the Maritime Observatory and we started investigating through normal human and OSINT sources and also through satellite technology. So Giles showed you some of the very excellent, very close-up pictures that he was able to get of the breaker's yard, which where the parts of ship were being brought and chucked unceremoniously into the yard to be melted down. Does that help?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And what does it look like in terms of your collaboration with government then? So if, for example, I mean, I think it was the work with St. Helena that you mentioned that you did with the Foreign Office. How does that work? And I mean, with your sort of three words that define you, the protection policy and research, how does that come into policy? Are there specific policy changes that you want to see, or is it specifically working with the Foreign Office on the with those projects?
The Foreign Office in particular, we invited ourselves to ask if they would like some advice on how to create a proper underwater cultural heritage legislation for British Antarctic Territory, not St. Helena's. That was a separate slide that Giles was talking about, a particular wreck that went there to die. So we invited ourselves, and then we, because there was no legislation for underwater cultural heritage there, we were in the very fortunate position of being able to bring in all the good bits from various different acts and put them together in one place, which is very rare that you can do that, and you can get rid of all the bits that you don't like. And it was from that that we then launched into looking at what they actually had underwater and what they might have had. And that took several months of research in various libraries and databases.
Amazing. That's really interesting. Thank you for that. And I'll now pass over to our lovely members and supporters who have awesome questions. So I'm going to start off with Will Radford.
Hello, hi Jessica, hi Giles. Nice to see you again, and thanks so much for taking part in this webinar. Really fascinating. As I mentioned to you, Giles, I think when we met in person, I have a particular interest around the Prince of Wales and the Repulse. I studied quite a bit at university about, you know, their fate, yeah, being destroyed by land-based Japanese bombers off the coast of Malaya, and all the documents up to, you know, why they were sent there, when they were sent there, and what happened before and after. So, you know, this being a very strong interest of mine, do we know what sort of percentage of these two magnificent pieces of history is actually left after these dastardly Chinese vessels have been, you know, chunking them up for scrap for so long? Because it's yeah, real tragedy, and you know, it's something I'm really passionate about. So hopefully you can tell me there's still enough of it left for it to count as a, you know, proper wreck and a, you know, decent war grave to those brave sailors.
Hi, Will. Good to see you again. And I was definitely thinking of you when I was giving the presentation as well. For the Prince of Wales, it's about it's good news and bad news. So the bad news is we do think because they had about 5 months worth of work on the site, they had plenty of time to remove a lot of the structure. And because we're seeing big elements like the anchors, which can only come from the bow, and the rudder and the steering mechanisms can only come from the stern, and the ammunition from the middle, it's likely that they've removed a lot of the upstanding hull from the seabed. The good news is, I'm not allowed to say too much, but we do know there have been some military surveys now done at the site, and there is still some material on the seabed. We are hoping that because these ships are effectively top heavy, when they sink, they nearly always turn upside down, and all the really, I suppose, interesting bits on the superstructure and the guns would have been forced into the seabed. We are hoping that particularly those magnificent large guns on the Prince of Wales are still there, waiting to be discovered, along with the turrets and maybe even the upper works, such as the bridge. Perhaps even the bell is still there somewhere as well. Repulse seemed to, was damaged about 10 years earlier as well, a bit more informally, and she seems to have fared better. So I think there's about 60% of her left. But again, don't tell the salvors that, because I might try and come back again.
Thanks a lot. Could be worse, I guess. Yeah, and very good that, you know, you guys are keeping a very close eye on it, because yeah, very important. Thanks a lot.
Absolute pleasure.
That's a really interesting question, I think, just hearing about the I mean, of course, the sort of, I guess, moral significance of having a war grave for those sailors, as well as the general protection of history. I think it's sort of twofold in that respect. We have a question from Geoff, who said, "Have you any dealings with the Montgomery sunk in the Thames estuary?"
Ooh. Oh dear, oh, we're not going to touch that literal time bomb, I don't think.
Literal time bomb.
There are some.
Yeah, go on.
I was going to say there are some very brave salvage companies that have been contracted to remove the masts from the Richard Montgomery. For those who don't know, she's a Second World War cargo ship carrying very dangerous cargo explosives. She's hit a sandbank in the Thames, and she's not moved to this day, and the cargo is still considered very dangerous. So there's a very delicate salvage operation that's going to take place at some point soon to remove the masts to prevent the danger of them falling over and possibly causing some of those explosives to ignite. I'd love to be involved, but we're not doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you guys ever do, dangerous sort of projects like that, or is it generally not that dangerous?
No. It's the short answer, because I want to live with all my limbs intact. This is the kind of thing for men with bombs and training in explosives, or even women. But no, it's the sort of you don't not many people want to go to Montgomery, and they do say that if it does go up, most of Kent goes with her. So it's to be avoided.
And those people won't be very popular, I'm assuming, if most of Kent go with it. I think all of London. Wow, that's a baffling thought. William Thornton says, "How do you determine whether tourists are able to visit a wreck or not?"
Charles, do you want to?
It's a delicate balancing act. I always think that wrecks belong to everyone, and people should be able to enjoy them as much as reasonably possible. In the UK, because we're dealing with bots, and so the legislation covers all the areas. There's a very small number of very significant historic vessels, including things like Mary Rose, Invincible, which we worked on, where they're so precious that we have to regulate access. But there's almost no sites where you can't visit them. You just have to get permission from a license to go and see them. And the determination, agencies that exist to determine that, such as Historic England. And it would always be a balance between the historical value, how fragile the historical value is. So does it have very fine fabrics that would disappear if you touch them? Or is it robust enough that it could take lots of visitors?
That's really interesting. So just a quick question to follow on from that. What is the current legislation or sort of the laws around tourist visits to those kind of projects? I mean, are there any specific regulations on that have come from the government in the UK, or is it predominantly sort of a top, a bottom up sort of regulation?
Jess, do you want to ask this, or shall I?
No, go. You might as well finish it.
I'll give you a really quick overview. There's a lot of different laws. We'd be really nice if we had just one law that covered everything, but through time, we've adopted bits of salvage law and bits of other legislation, like conservation legislation and military rules, to cover wrecks. So there's lots of different bits of rules that cover it. In general, the presumption is, if there's a shipwreck on the seabed and you find it, you're able to visit it. And if it doesn't have an owner, you're able to also salvage things from it, as long as you report it and go through the proper channels to ensure that you get the reward that you deserve, and the owner gets their property back as well. There's a few bits of legislation, such as the Protection of Military Remains Act, that protects very sensitive wrecks that may have war dead inside them from being disturbed. And there's some archaeological laws, such as the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act, that protects those very historic shipwrecks and protects those. But if you're in any doubt, Definitely Google it because there's some really good resources out there. And we give a really good lecture as part of our basic archaeological diver course as well, where we introduce divers to the thorny world of legislation, what they can and can't do underwater.
That's really interesting. So it's actually part of your course that you do with divers, so that they themselves know what they're allowed to do. I suppose that does make sense. Adrian asks, how many known shipwrecks are there around the UK and in UK waters?
Oh, well,
Putting you on the spot there.
there's a ballpark figure. Well, first of all, that we've got more shipwrecks than any other country on Earth, which is a bold statement. But given that we've been an island nation for quite some time, it's not that bold. So the kind of the going figures around about 50,000. But of them, they're only, what is the figure now for protected wrecks? I think it's 53, I'm not sure, under one particular act, and then some others are protected under other acts. So it is a little bit complicated, as Giles said. But yeah, it is a lot. So I did write a book about a small section of the South Devon coastline. And when researching it, I realized that really, if these wrecks were on the surface, you could hop along them all the way from Salcombe to Plymouth.
That's incredibly interesting. So the UK has the most shipwrecks in the world. That's incredible. Do you know what period most of them have come from? Are they sort of recent history or a lot older?
Well, the vast majority. I mean, you could have a look on our Royal Navy loss list just to give you a flavour of the military ones, but the vast majority are going to be First and Second World War. But we do go back to the Bronze Age, where certain we've worked on sites in South Devon of Bronze Age sites. So, yeah.
That's amazing. Sorry, could you talk a little bit more about the Bronze Age sites? I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, how, yeah, hundreds of years old, and you guys have been able to help conserve them, and that's incredible. Could you talk a little bit
Well,
about that project? Sorry.
it's not my specific project. It's Bournemouth University's, but it was discovered by a lot of the great discoveries are done just by divers diving, just what they're known as avocational divers, and a whole bunch of these guys used to get together at weekends, and they came across they were using their hands, and somebody came across some gold coins, and then they kept going, and they found more, and they found trinkets, and it's believed to be related to Bronze Age field system just above the site. It's very interesting, and can now you can go and learn more about it at the British Museum, where they've got a lot of the artifacts.
That's really incredible. That's so interesting. I'm not sure if I'm seeing any more questions in the chat. But just before we finish up, I wondered if you guys could tell us a little bit about how we can keep up to date with MAST and what sort of social media platforms you're on, what can we find on your website, and how can we help support the amazing work that you guys do.
Charles, would you like to take that one?
Oh, absolutely. So I suppose the most update way you can tune into us is go on to Twitter. We keep a fairly active profile there. We do have other social media accounts as well. Also, if you Google MAST or Maritime Archaeology Sea Trust, we have a really good website which links to all the sort of projects we've done before, and there's a lot of downloadable content from reports to photographs to newsletters. So you can, excuse the pun, you can dive into our work as deep as you want to go.
That's incredibly interesting. Thank you. We do actually have one more question from Adrian. He says, for each of you, what is the most interesting shipwreck archaeology that you've been involved with yourself?
Well, certainly for me, the most exciting find I've ever found was a ship's bell. I think that I'm told it's the earliest ship's bell ever found, 1498, which was from the Esmeralda, which was a Vasco da Gama warship, on her way back from India, on the way to, excuse me. off the coast of south coast of Oman, and it was just a very exciting thing to find in the sand, not that deep, there it was, and it helped us identify the ship. But we weren't quite sure before, but the markings were quite clear along the side of the bell as well. So that's mine, Giles. I'm not sure what Giles is.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I can compete with that. It's a good few years ago now, but I used to do a lot of volunteering in Mediterranean with the Institute for Nautical Archaeology, which is a US outfit. And we were lucky enough to excavate a Roman stone-carrying ship that was carrying half a flat-pack temple and a lot of gravestones from the second century AD on its way to the temple before it sank. And we actually were able to track down the temple that this column was supposed to go to, and it was never finished because they ran out of money. And there's even a spot where this column, which we found on the shipwreck, was supposed to go, but was never, obviously, never made it.
That's brilliant.
Those are both very, very brilliant answers, I must say. Thank you both so much. I mean, that was incredibly interesting. I must say, one of the most interesting webinars that we've had, I think. Maybe that's just coming from me as a bit of a history nerd, but it really is incredible. It's like finding little time capsules across the world. That's really incredible. So thank you very much, Jessica and Giles, for that wonderful conversation. And make sure everybody keeps up to date with with their Twitter and with their social media platforms and on their website. Yeah, thank you so much again. I'm really, really impressed with how interesting that really was. Just a quick update from FOTBOT. We have a couple of other events coming up in the next few months that you should all be aware of. On the 23rd of April, we have the St. Helena fundraising launch reception. So make sure you come to that if you are interested. We'll have, I believe, Andrew Gwynn, MP, who will be there as well. And we'll effectively be talking about St. Helena and
And
the fact
Sarah
that they.
Buckland MP, Reem, a friend of yours, I believe.
And Sarah Buckland MP. So we've got two members of Parliament that will be there. Thank you, Oliver. And we're aiming to raise £8,000 towards equipment. So in St Helena, they actually only have one hospital and one care home. And with all of the high pressures that they're facing at the moment, the St Helena Disabled Society are really eager to help disabled and elderly people stay in their own homes as long as possible, and sort of giving them that kind of autonomy before then. Ever having to use other services. So we're trying to raise £8,000. Please do come. We've got, Sir Rob Buckland MP and the lovely Andrew Gwynn MP that will be attending that as well. We also have our charity barbecue, which will be happening on the 16th of July, which is always good fun. For those of you that came last year, you'll remember how amazing it was. Barbecue is good food. It's always good fun. So please do come. And of course, again, if you haven't got your ticket for our December gala, please do. You get the early bird, and that will be on the 5th of December as well. I know many of you were also there last year. It's always good fun. And I don't know, Oliver, do you have anything to add?
No.
All good, amazing, wonderful. All right, well, thank you all so much. Have a really, really lovely evening, and the recording for the webinar will be on available online and in the form of a podcast now. Thank you so much, guys. Have a lovely evening.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you, guys.
you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.